I'm Rebecca Cohen.
And I'm Maya Garantz.
And this is The Sauce, the culture and politics podcast where we drink cocktails and ruin the stuff you love.
Well, guys, we just want to show you that we can ruin anything.
Anything at all.
So today we're going to catch up on a lot of listener feedback and a lot of podcast business. And we're going to talk to you guys about the NPR raccoon who riveted thousands of people for 24 hours.
This raccoon and his very dramatic saga being stuck on a tall building just captured everyone's imagination. And we are ready to ruin that for you. And then after that is done, we have some hot sauce and weak sauce awards to give away because there's lots going on. So we should
Let's
do all that.
Let's get to it. Let's do it.
Okay, before we get into the meat of our episode, we should talk about what we're drinking and also how we're doing. So Maya, how's it going? And what are you drinking?
It's going all right. Summer is here and you should just feel it every day and the vibe in my house. It's just like summer already, which is very nice. I am drinking an old fashioned, a good rye old fashioned. And I've noticed that since starting to do this podcast with you, I go through the hard liquor much more quickly. And also, I always seem to have simple syrup made in the fridge.
That's smart. If you're going to have cocktails, it's nice to have simple syrup on hand. So I respect that.
And you?
I am drinking red wine from the box. I have the box right next to me for convenience sake. I just got lazy. Next week, I'll have a fancy cocktail to talk about. Right now, I'm going to do a little unpaid advertisement. Everyone, Trader Joe's, red wine in a box. It's fucking fantastic. I love it.
But how are you doing?
Oh, I am doing fine. I'm doing fine, as well as can be expected. I just got back from Texas, where my parents and my sister and her brood live. And my niece, Marcy, was graduating from high school, which is why I was there. And she's going to Cal. She's going to Cal Berkeley in the fall.
Yes!
Congratulations, which is really awesome, except that Matt and I just moved away from Berkeley. So it's kind of bummer and ironic.
You don't want to be there for whatever she's going to go through.
Oh, we do. I mean, no, we do. That's like, we would love to be there. I mean, we just have this whole vision of ourselves like crashing all her classes, just like showing up at her dorm, you know, making her life miserable. But unfortunately, we will not be able to do that. And there was like a whole thing. My parents have always been weirdly Republican. They definitely have had their minds warped by Fox News over the last like year in a way that is disturbing. And I love them so much. And I'm just like trying to deal with it by saying they're old and they do not live in a swing state. So it's fine. It doesn't really matter. It's disappointing.
Look, you know what? I made a rule because my dad was radicalized by Fox News. He was like a nice Rockefeller Republican. Just don't touch my taxes, but otherwise straight up California Republican.
Yeah, my parents too.
And my father and I made a deal and we have not discussed politics since 2003.
That's a long time. That's very impressive. It's weird because my father and I have had a long-standing tradition of sort of trolling each other about politics. I almost spit out her drink when I said that. But it's a thing we do where he's like, you know, Rebecca, Italy has a 37% unemployment rate for people over 40. What do you think about that? And, you know, he reads The Economist and all these other things, and he likes to pick and choose little things that he thinks will needle me.
Right.
And I'll do the same in reverse, except mine is actually rational. But we can't do it anymore because it's not funny anymore. It's not.
Yeah.
I can't shrug it off. If they're going to defend Trump, I can't. Like now, we have to have that moratorium. It's like I'm not going there.
I really think that it's been helpful. My mom is like, she grew up in a family that was like two parties to the left of the Labor Party. I mean, my grandmother was like a communist. She wasn't even a Zionist. She was like a communist.
Yeah.
And my mom is still like,
I'm sure I've mentioned this before. My favorite quote from my mom in the past 2 years has been that she can't wait until she sees Jared Kushner in an orange jumpsuit picking up trash on the side of the road. Like,
that's
she is
wonderful.
Like,
so how's she, is she still with your dad? Or are they,
that's what I'm saying.
Dealing
they've been
with that?
Together. They've been together now for like 35 years. They love each other. They have a great marriage, but I actually think that this administration has been very hard on their marriage.
I would think it would be. I'm sorry. It's hard for me to even imagine having very different politics from your significant other. It's too important to me.
Yeah.
I know that people do it. That's in itself is not the same thing as like your partner is a Fox News watcher.
Yeah. So I feel like we made it actually an explicit. It wasn't just that I stopped talking about it. We
right.
made it an explicit rule. We do not talk about politics, end of story. And I feel like it's been a lot better. And I'm hoping that my parents are doing that right now, because my mother is watching Rachel Maddow like fucking straight to the vein.
Yeah, yeah. That's really kind of amazing to me. I mean, I know my mom's best friend in the world is super liberal. And she was like at the Women's March, and she calls her senators like every day, and she's super activated and, you know, hashtag resist. So they somehow make it work. They're BFFs. They talk about, I don't know, what they, skincare products and like, I don't know, whatever you talk about when you're in your 60s and have a best friend. Yeah. I feel like, okay, they can do it. I can do it. I can just be like, hey, we have different politics. That's fine. Let's not talk about it.
Yeah.
It's hard,
yeah.
though.
Oh. Oh.
Okay. We have a ton of great listener feedback that we've got to get to and respond to.
But in order to share it, we have to reveal something really embarrassing, which is that for many months, we were not checking our Gmail because we didn't assume that anyone was writing. And then we checked it and we're like, oh shit, you guys are writing.
Bunch of great emails. Yeah. At the end of each episode, we say, reach out to us at saucepodcast@gmail.com. And somehow I just assumed nobody was. So we didn't even look. But recently we looked, we found a bunch of great emails. And even since we checked, more great emails have come in. So we wanted to share with you, listeners, some of the messages that we got and respond to some of them.
And for some of you newer listeners, this is in some ways a tour through our old episodes.
Right. Right.
A million years ago, we did an episode about rom-coms. Matthew Elmsley wrote us a great email. We were talking about When Harry Met Sally and how it's the peak of the form
yes.
of the romantic comedy.
It's the rom-com that we both really love.
Totally. And he writes that he thinks that When Harry Met Sally lacks the courage of its convictions. It pretends to answer the question, can men and women be friends or does the sex get in the way? But it doesn't. And he thinks that to answer that question, it would have to either end with Harry and Sally being friends or them not being friends because sex got in the way.
Right. So the fact that it ends with them becoming romantically involved, they're not really friends and they're not friends. So it's sort of like an out that
yes.
doesn't answer the question.
So I would like to share with Matt. Thank you so much for writing us. Write us again. We will absolutely check our email. Here's the thing is that actually the original script has them not ending up together and the sex had gotten in the way.
Oh, really?
And when they tested that version of it, nobody liked it because everybody was so invested in wanting them to get together.
Right.
So they rewrote and reshot the ending. So actually the initial movie was absolutely going to do what you said and shows sex getting in the way. But then those damn audiences ruined it with their romantic desires.
I never knew that. That's really interesting. Mm-hmm. I wonder how I would have liked that movie. That sounds like an unsatisfying ending, I have to
yeah.
admit. It sounds disappointing. Like, why couldn't it have ended with them just continuing to be friends?
Right.
Imagine that. They have a little
right.
tiff, and then instead of him doing this grand romantic gesture and like finding her at the New Year's party and giving her this speech, I love all these things about you. I love this. I love that. The truth is I love you. It could be a grand romantic friend speech. It could be like, I don't want to end our friendship. The sex didn't get in the way. I'm still your friend. I still want to hang out with you. And then it could end with them just being friends.
Totally.
I think it could have worked.
I think so too. I think so too. And I think that they wanted to go there, but then they could not. So there you go. Now we're going to jump ahead a couple of months to an episode we did about our origin story.
Yes.
And how that relates to how we think about portraying female desire in media. Because we wrote a romance novel together in high school.
That's right. We... If you want to learn more about it, just got to find that episode, which was a follow-up to our episode about romance novels and female erotica and how female desire is depicted and also sort of catered to or isn't in various media.
And actually, it was the end of a 3-episode arc.
That's right. We had a lot to say. But when we were teens, yes, we composed our own semi-ironic romance novel. And one of the things we talked about in recalling that is how it was in many ways an outlet for us to express thoughts we were having and issues we were dealing with without being serious about it.
That's right.
So we should read this great email we got from Rachel.
Oh my God, it's so good.
She says, I love the newest episode about your origin story, and I wanted to tell you about the epic romance novel / fan fiction I had written with my best friend in our freshman year of high school. We lived in a very conservative farm town where a Christian or Mormon church could be found every half mile. So... just to summarize, very conservative area, no open talk about sex. We decided to write our own self-insert fan fiction in a shared notebook. In our story, two girls fell into a video game world, I love this, where all of our favorite characters resided. This included Link from Legend of Zelda, Snake from Metal Gear, numerous characters from Fire Emblem, and even Mario and Luigi.
I love it.
I love it.
So this is my favorite line. We wrote of fights, adventures, puns, and how every single character wanted to fuck us. Yeah!
Oh, I mean, I'm so delighted by the idea that Mario and Luigi wanted to fuck you.
But also, I love that in the notebook, they would sort of exchange it back and forth every few days.
Yeah.
And she wrote, it was a place of solace where we could write and share our sexual fantasies without judgment. It's like so beautiful.
That's lovely. Although she continues, eventually my mom found the journal in my backpack and was not happy. That's pretty mortifying. So she refused to reveal who wrote the story with her. She writes, it's funny thinking back on this time when we considered this story to be an important part of our lives. My mom has definitely loosened up over the years and we regularly smoke pot together now.
Yay! Go mom. Happy ending.
So thank you, Rachel, for writing in. Thank you for sharing that awesome story. And now I will never get the image of Mario and Luigi and having sex out of my head. So great.
I think there might be Mario and Luigi porn. There's porn for everything.
There's porn for everything.
There's like dinosaur porn.
That's a rule. Rule 34, I think they call it.
Have you ever seen the dinosaur porn?
Wait, is that...
Like, they're men dressed up as dinosaurs, with full body suits.
So men in dinosaur suits, having sex with each other? Sure, why wouldn't there be? Why wouldn't that exist? I mean, come on. Next email I want to share is a more recent one. So this one's from listener JP Kelly, who is responding to one of our more recent episodes where we talked about our escapist pleasures that are helping us get our minds off this moment in time and all the shit. And one of the things we mentioned was Marvel movies, which is my big escapist pleasure. And we had some disagreement. We also had in a much earlier episode disagreed around Thor Ragnarok, which I liked a lot, but Maya found lacking. But JP had a bunch of great stuff to say. First of all, he started with, you guys are great, I am a fan, which is a great way to start an email. Thank you, JP.
Yeah, always.
He says, I love both your very different perspectives. Rebecca the insider and Maya the outsider. this is specifically in regard to the Marvel conversation, but both with similar psychological, social, and cultural filters. I'd love to hear a podcast devoted entirely to Marvel movies. What do you think, Maya?
I think I can do it because you have certain movies that you keep bringing up where you're like, okay, but you have to see.
Yeah.
I think it's like Winter Soldier. Like you have this like list. Mm-hmm. So I feel like we could do an episode where you like send me the list of the ones I have to watch and we just lock me in a room.
Right.
And I watch all of them. And then we have to just like throw down.
I like that a lot. I also like the idea of we could make you watch every Marvel movie because it could be a whole podcast. It could be a whole series. And you watch a Marvel movie and then we talk about it. As someone who's never seen any Marvel movies, it's totally new to you. And then you can watch the next one.
That's That's a lot of weeks. I don't know that I can do like 19 weeks of that. And it's funny because JP says, how do you think Marvel movies might influence preteens now that they can watch all 19 movies on DVD in a week? That's why I think like watching like a big cluster of them might be interesting because it's like experiencing it like a binge fantasy, like you got to the show four seasons in and you can just like,
well, it is a lot like that. And that's one of the points I made about the Marvel movies is they are almost like a TV series. They build on one another in a way that makes them very bingeable. So what influence would they have on preteens of today isn't a question I'm not quite prepared to answer.
We'll get there.
I will say that I noticed that I think young people, I always assume everyone online is young, so I don't really know if this is true, but I will say that online, like on Tumblr, there's a fandom, obviously, around them, and there's a kind of fan involvement and a kind of excitement about the characters and their relationships. They have these sort of memes, like Science Bros, I think it's called, where Tony and Bruce are like science buddies that go around being awesome and doing science stuff. And it's like this whole, it's this whole world of fan content, not just fan fiction, which is definitely part of it, but fan content around the Marvel movies, around the characters. There's comic strips that people make and illustrations. And I think there's really something to that. It's so participatory. You can see in it this deep feeling of connection that people have to the characters.
Right.
And I think that that's different from anything I ever experienced when I was young.
Right. Well, we're going to think about this, JP. We're going to think about how to approach this.
Yeah.
And he's also talking about, do we think the Avengers are more conservative, the X-Men more progressive? Like, there are a lot of really good questions here.
That is an interesting question. I mean, the X-Men is certainly trying to be progressive.
All right. No, we're not going to get into this right now.
Okay.
We're going to think about this. We'll be back to you, JP.
Yeah. Thank you, JP, for the great email and the excellent questions. If anyone else has some thoughts about these topics or other topics we've discussed or topics you'd like to hear us talk about, you too can reach out to us. We are saucepodcast@gmail.com and we are now checking that account and we'll see your email. So please do. Still on the topic of listener feedback, we also got some great tweets. There was one I particularly wanted to share. Hidden Messages on Twitter tweeted at us, if you aren't listening to The Sauce, you should be. They're far more insightful and lucid when tipsy than most people are when sober.
That's right.
Thank you.
That's absolutely right. Thank you so much.
If anyone wants to tweet at us about how beautiful our eyes are, you can tell us more about our eyes. I know you can't see them, but you can imagine.
Well, you can imagine them. They're twinkling and dark and flashing and Jewy.
Yes. Slow-eyed.
Yeah. That's
whatever that means. In Ivanhoe, the character Rebecca is repeatedly described as a slow-eyed Jewess. So identify with that, whatever it might mean.
Slow-eyed Jewesses whose eyes reveal the insane intelligence lurking behind them.
Wow, that's good.
I think so. We have so many things that are on our agenda to talk about with you guys, but we really felt like the NPR raccoon, who was a raccoon in St. Paul, Minnesota, who was seen scaling a 25-story skyscraper in the middle of the city and was noticed and started being followed by Minnesota Public Radio and was a hardcore trending like phenomenon for 24 hours. Actually got at something really interesting that we wanted to get into.
And this is fresh because as we are recording, this just resolved this morning. Yes. They rescued the raccoon. And I honestly wasn't sure if I was going to be able to go to sleep last night, not knowing if the raccoon was going to be okay.
And also the images that they caught of this raccoon, it's like a raccoon and it's like hugging the outside of this building.
Yeah, just hanging on for dear life with its all arms spread. Limbs. Yeah.
And it's an office building, so the windows don't open. So every once in a while, he would sort of hit a floor and sort of hang out on the ledge to like rest. And people would take pictures of it from the inside, but they couldn't open the window to let him in. And at one point, he started going down the building. Mm-hmm. And then he started climbing back up the building. And it was like super intense.
Very dramatic. And everyone was tweeting about it. It was really a Twitter event. A lot of people were very concerned. Of course, it was covered in local news in the area, but also probably national news. I mean,
right.
if you even just go Google raccoon right now, like just the word raccoon,
everything
on the front page is like CNN,
People
New York
Magazine.
Times. Yeah.
People Magazine did an article about this damn raccoon.
Yeah. So let's talk about the fucking raccoon. Goddamn raccoon. There's so many ways into talking about this. I feel like it is, as we mentioned at the top of the episode, a real test of our ability to ruin things. Because everyone's so happy about this raccoon.
And everybody was so concerned about this raccoon. Well, first of all, I just want to briefly talk about
raccoons.
A little bit. Because I'm looking at this image of the raccoon.
Okay.
And okay, so I'm going to find the name of this artist and tweet it. But I was on an artist residency a million years ago at the Atlantic Center for the Arts in Florida. Mm-hmm. And there was this photographer there who loved taking photos of people who have certain kinds of like intense relationships to animals. So she took these beautiful photos of like the goat roping queen of Nebraska or whatever. And while we were in Florida on this residency, she found this a couple who lived near where the residency center was who had this pet raccoon that was apparently like huge, like 30 pounds. Like this was like a massive raccoon. And the raccoon knew to like open the refrigerator door and grab an egg and then in its paws would like pass the egg back and forth in its paws till it warmed up enough for him to like eat it.
Amazing. Like, it's fucking amazing.
There's something both humanoid and bear-like about the raccoon.
This is my first theory about the raccoon is that it's its hands. It's all about the raccoon's hands. They're so human-like. You know, there are many animals that could get caught on a ledge, but like if it had been a squirrel, I think we'd all be like, you know, squirrels come and go. But a raccoon, it's got a little mask on its face. It washes its food. They're like almost humanoid in their way. They are like mini bears, but they're like people bears. So I think right there's going to be this like fascination and emotional connection. They're really weirdly likable creatures for horrible pests that eat garbage and will rough up your actual pets.
UC Santa Barbara, where I was teaching, UC Santa Barbara's mascot for a million years has been the gauchos, which people are finally like, that shit is racist and let's clear it up. And so they might be changing their mascot to the raccoon.
Oh, really?
To the UC Santa Barbara raccoons.
Okay. Well, they're going to sell a lot of merch to furries. Furries love raccoons, as I understand.
But I think that what you're saying is they're like small like a house cat, but they're, like house cats with actual hands.
Yeah.
Because you know how like cartoons always turn animals
into these cuddly things? Yes, they anthropomorphized.
Even in their own form, they're anthropomorphic.
Exactly.
They're like anthropomorphic as they are. You don't even have to like make a cartoon of it to anthropomorphize. Yeah,
that's why they're amazing.
All right.
So that's reason number one that the raccoon grabbed everyone's imagination. But I feel like possibly a bigger reason is this phenomenon of the live event. Something happening in real time that we're following and watching.
Yes.
And I think in that sense, it has some significance in a larger cultural context.
I think major media, I think the big move of major media, I would say in the past 20 years, even more so than the internet facilitated this, but it's not the thing, is on demand. That right. TV and media is accessible on demand. You get to watch it when you want it. You get to TiVo it. You get to, like, whenever you want it. Now you get to stream it. There is no more waiting for the next week's show. You even see it now when they'll release, like, a whole season of a show at once.
Right, like on Netflix.
Absolutely.
The concept of the live event, you know, there was a time when television was all live and there was no recording it and watching it later. And if you missed it, you know, you go to work the next day or school the next day and people are like, even when we were kids, you go to school the next day, people are like, did you see what happened on the Cosby Show?
I was literally thinking Cosby Show.
Because that's the one we talked about. It was the popular show. And we talk about it and repeat the jokes that we thought were funny. But we had all watched it at the same time. And if you missed it, you missed it. And you weren't going to see it again, at least until the summer when it would be rerun.
And then it's also the same with news. That news was not 24 hours. You watched it in that hour.
Yeah.
And that's it. You wait for the morning. You wait for like your newspaper to come in. You did not have the same loop of like, oh, I'll get it on the next loop. There was no fucking loop.
Exactly. So, and especially like you said, with streaming and on demand and TiVo, that live phenomenon, it still exists to some extent because when everyone else has seen the new episode of Game of Thrones, you don't want to be the one asshole who hasn't seen it yet and is like, don't talk about it in front of me. But you also have the total option of watching it at your leisure. So I think that there is a demand for live events. I think people want that. They enjoy that feeling of being part of something live, like the Super Bowl or almost any sporting event.
And that's actually something that I've noticed is that there's so much drive to on demand because that's what people want. Mm-hmm. And yet in the march to on demand, it actually creates this simultaneous desire for the live event, for us to all be in the same place at the same time. Yeah. And that's why things like the Super Bowl have increased in viewership. People want to be there at the same time. People want to be witnessing something at the same time. That's why NBC has been doing live musicals, I'm convinced.
Oh, that's a really great point.
Because we are all watching it at the same time. That's why things like election nights, the debates.
Yes.
I think that people are so starving for that. And also I think so much of media right now is so split and we are not all watching the same three channels anymore.
Right.
And and so a lot of us are living these very different realities. And so I feel like anytime our reality can come together and we are all watching the same thing, I think that that is deeply necessary as humans. I think we need it.
And I think it speaks to people's fear of missing out as well.
That's right.
Yeah. The role of social media is really interesting because I think it amplifies that effect. You don't have to wait till you get to work the next day and everyone's talking about it around the water cooler. It's happening right now live in your Twitter feed. And if you are not being part of it, you know, right there in that moment.
Yes. And I think that what I've noticed a lot on social media is the creation of those events. There's one that John Ronson writes about in his book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, where he talks about the sort of social media pylon, where there's this one woman who wrote some really shitty joke about how, like, I'm going to Africa, I hope I don't get AIDS. Like, and she had, like, you know, 200 followers of her buddies. And all of a sudden, people started retweeting it. And she was on the flight.
Yeah.
And everybody was waiting for her flight to land so she could open up her social media and see that she had gone viral and that people fucking hated
her. Hated her.
It was like,
yeah. It's the classic story of an internet pylon.
Yes.
But really interesting how the liveness of that moment contributed to it. It wasn't like, oh, here's a thing that somebody tweeted 3 days ago. It's like, this is happening right now. Come join the mob. Grab your pitchfork now.
Yep. Yep.
Don't miss out.
Totally. Also, though, you were mentioning the sort of live. Sometimes there's a nice side to it. There was a guy on Twitter a few weeks ago who the neighbor's cat gave birth under his bed. And all of a sudden he like discovered all of these newborn kittens and spent the next 24 hours like tweeting. And we were all watching him as he was becoming a cat dad.
Yes. And you can find that if you search hashtag cat dad. And it was absolutely delightful thread. There was another one on Twitter. I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of the guy who tweeted it, but he was tweeting about how somebody stole someone else's lunch in his office and they were about to look at the security cam in the break room. They were going to look at the security cam footage to see who did it. And he continues to tweet about the guy whose lunch was stolen was taken to another room to watch the footage. He comes back. He tells everyone who it was that stole it. The thief is currently out of the office. And this guy continues to tweet about, like, she comes back to the office. Is he going to confront her? And he's live tweeting their interaction. And he's talking about his reaction, how suspenseful it is. And it just went viral and everyone was following it. I remember following it live and that was the excitement of it. It was still an entertaining thread regardless, but it was a very interesting example of a uniquely social media moment where people from all over are following this one guy's story. You know, it's not a big sports event or the Oscars or anything.
Totally.
It's this one guy having drama in his office that's so relatable and everyone just hanging on his every tweet to find out what's going to happen.
Absolutely. Because it's live. We are watching this mystery about to unfold live.
And it's a sense of community as well, being part of something bigger than yourself.
Yes.
So the other aspect of the raccoon story that I think is kind of interesting, I got to give credit to Cameron Bennett on Twitter, who tweeted in response to me. I was tweeting about how I can't go to sleep until I know if the raccoon's going to be okay. And they responded, NPR raccoon is the new baby Jessica.
Wow.
And that really got me thinking about baby Jessica.
Wow.
For our younger listeners, perhaps we should catch them up.
Yes, absolutely.
This was a news event that happened, what, like 1987?
It was 1987. This 18-month-old baby fell into a well.
In the backyard.
Yes.
People still have wells.
Well, they do in Midland, Texas.
Yeah. But the well, when we say well, like you picture like a big stone thing and you put a bucket down. But this thing was like maybe a foot in diameter or something. It was
big deal. It's just this little well. But it was deep. It was a deep well.
But the point being that it was small enough in diameter that nobody thought it was a danger. Nobody thought to cover it or anything. And this 18-month-old or whatever fell down it and got stuck. And it became this event as rescuers attempted to dig into the ground next to the well and tunnel over and rescue this baby. And the entire nation was just wrapped, was just obsessed with the fate of this child.
Right.
Who lived? She was rescued, thankfully.
Yeah. But that was a baby, though. That was like a human baby.
It was a human baby. I mean, there was also, you brought up the Chilean miners that got caved in some years ago. And that was another saga. I mean, that was more than just a couple of days, though. That was like a long,
that was a long time. And that was like, and I don't mean to in any way denigrate, like if my 18-month-old was at the bottom of a 20-foot well for 48 hours, I'd not be so into it. Like, I'm not, you know, but this was like dozens of miners who were trapped thousands of feet underground.
Yeah, it was.
It was like, oh my God.
All of these situations kind of made me think about the ways that people are made to care about something. Yes, the liveness is obviously incredibly important, but it's also something to do with the specificity, being able to point to one individual baby caught in a well or one individual raccoon on a ledge, that you're able to focus your concern on this one individual. They start to have an identity and there's going to be an outcome. It's going to be resolved.
Right. Right. Okay. So first of all, we have to mark the idea of suspense.
Yes.
So it's liveness, but it's the liveness of suspense.
Yeah.
It's the same live. It's always like, what's going to happen? That's why the lunch guy thing is so exciting. What's going to happen? What's going to happen when that woman's plane lands and she finds out all of Twitter hates her? What's going to happen in this like ball game? So I feel like there's that suspense.
Yes.
And then there is like, what is it about this character that inspires our attention? Like, actually, I think it was a couple of weeks ago where that one baby was hanging outside of a building.
The guy like climbed up like Spider-Man. That was in France?
Yes.
Oh my
yes.
God. That was wild.
It was wild.
Boy, there's a whole bunch we could say about that one too.
But it was too quick. It was too quick to have that suspense of us
wasn't
watching.
A live event because it just happened very quickly. But then went viral afterwards.
Right. So what is it about a fucking raccoon climbing a building? So we know what it is about baby Jessica. She's this like cute blonde baby at the bottom of a well. And it's like terrible.
How you're not going to care.
What is it about a fucking raccoon on a building? What is it?
So I think this goes back to the reason that everyone hated Michael Vick so much when it was revealed that he was abusing dogs. Mm-hmm. And I remember having conversations with people where they were like, yeah, that's bad. But like, people are so worked up about it. People are acting like he's fucking Hitler and other people have done way worse stuff to people. So why is abusing dogs it immediately evokes this universal, very angry condemnation when ongoing abuse of people kind mm-hmm. of gets just accepted as a piece of reality.
Yeah.
And I think that connects to the raccoon. I think a big part of it is the idea that the animal, particularly a dog, like dogs, we have bred to be dependent upon us and mm-hmm. to love us. So when someone mistreats a dog that we have bred to depend on us, it's like particularly perverse. But generally speaking, with animals, they can't comprehend their situation. And I think there's something really just like, it just evokes something visceral in us when we see a creature that is kind of innocent and can't comprehend its own situation and it's stuck there and it doesn't know really how it got there or why or how to get out of it. And we have so much larger knowledge than it does. We know what happened and how to fix it and yet we can't, which, by the way, I don't believe that no one could have rescued that fucking raccoon. Like, there's window washers. Window washers go up on the side of buildings every day. I just think there must have been a way. But whatever, that's another conversation.
Okay, but that's also making me think about the fact, so you have this innocent creature caught in a giant problem which it doesn't quite understand.
Yeah.
I also think that there is something that felt heroic about this tiny creature climbing up a fucking 25, 35 story building. Mm-hmm. Where this, like, it's like this heroic act. It's scaling a building. Okay. We would like to scale a building.
I see that.
I think that's totally part of it. And there was something indomitable. He'd rest.
Right.
And then he'd keep fucking going.
Can't really climb down. So he had to climb up. I know,
but there was this way in which there was no quit in that raccoon. I think that's part of the appeal.
Sure, that makes it kind of relatable. I get that.
I also think that as much suspense as there was, mm-hmm. if it had not made it, it only would have been a raccoon. So it's not the same as if it was a child.
That's fair. That's fair. I think people would have expressed being upset, but more as like a performative thing on Twitter than like genuinely being super upset. Like if it were a child, it would be horrible. But I mean, part of that is just empathy. Like yeah. we have children in our lives. Many of us have our own. Anyway, you do. I don't. But I know many children. I've known and enjoyed a few of them. And so it's very easy to put ourselves in the position of like baby Jessica's mom and dad and say like, oh right. my God, what if that were my child? The specificity of the situation activates our empathy. We can put ourselves there.
So in some ways, thinking about it, I'm like, it's this perfect storm. Mm-hmm. You have this creature that is probably one of the most perfectly, almost anthropomorphic version of itself.
Yes.
You have an act that almost feels heroic. There's a great deal of suspense.
Yes.
There is empathy and concern. And it has stakes, but not the stakes of like a real fucking baby at the bottom of like a 20-foot tunnel.
Right.
And so it's the perfect combination. Like, I bet there are people at Disney working on the movie of it
right now.
It's all of those things at once, and so it's providing people this kind of escapist relief, which is something that we've been talking about in the past few weeks.
Yeah, exactly. With all the shit going on, you got all this shit that you don't want to think about, and this actually, in its suspensefulness, is a relief. It's something to give your attention to and hope for a happy ending for. It is a kind of escapism to care about something that is, in the big picture, trivial. It's trivial.
Yes. Yeah.
But like, it's really easy to get emotionally invested in because yes. of all the factors we discussed. So you can sort of invest yourself, your emotions in something, yeah, that ultimately is kind of low stakes, but feels like it's not low stakes and yes. connects you to all these other people and just gets your mind off the shit you don't want to be thinking about.
Because one of the things that I found hard about the raccoon, because I was totally like into it for 5 minutes. Mm. It's like I read the tweets and I was like, I have to go to bed. I'm sure in the morning it'll be fine.
Right.
But one of the things that's hard for me, because I think one of the things that's been keeping me up at night are these immigrant children being put in like tent camps in El Paso and old broken down Walmart stores where they're being given 2 hours a day of like free play and 1 hour a day to go outside. And I'm like, why do people give a shit about this panda? Like, why aren't children, particularly children of color, accorded that same empathy, specifically right. the empathy towards their innocence? That's the thing that's like killing me. We love the raccoon because we know he's innocent. When children are in trouble, that's the part about them. They're innocent. They don't know what's going on. But somehow we attribute a kind of knowingness mm-hmm. specifically to children of color, and we're not giving them that same empathy.
Yeah. And it's interesting because the word that comes to my mind is dehumanized, that we dehumanize them, but that's not even apt because the attention and empathy is going to a fucking raccoon.
That's right. We're humanizing the raccoon. We're making the raccoon.
We're humanizing the raccoon and we're dehumanizing the actual children.
Yeah.
And I will grant that, for example, I mean, that's one example of a million. There's also like kids in Syria and there's poor children within the United States. There's all just like kids all over the world who are suffering in a lot of different ways. And they have that innocence. They meet all the baby Jessica requirements. They check all the boxes, except that they're faceless. They're kind of faceless. Yeah. And that's a big problem. If you had one child, if the story were this one specific child got taken away from his parents, it might, like, you give the kid a name. Like, okay, remember that kid, the Cuban kid? Elian Gonzalez.
Elian Gonzalez.
He had come from Cuba, and like his dad died on the way, drowned perhaps. Mm-hmm. They came into the country, and or his mom died on the way, and the dad, who was still in Cuba, tried to get custody of the kid, and ultimately the legal authorities decided that the parent in Cuba had legal custody, and that the kid had to be removed. And right. he was staying with relatives in Florida, and it became this national story, this one child, this one immigrant right. child, because right. he had a face and a name, and he was a cute little chubby-cheeked five-year-old kid.
That's right.
And also because people could project onto it whatever they wanted to believe.
About Cuba and about human yeah, rights.
Exactly, and about immigration and whatever. So that was very fraught in its way, but it is an example of where a face and a name were given and empathy was allowed for that non-white kid.
You know where else I'm thinking about?
What?
So I'm reminded of Nayira, who pretended to be a 15-year-old girl.
Oh my God.
Who gave testimony to the Congressional Human Rights Caucus. Mm-hmm. And that testimony was sort of pointed to by Bush, by H.W., Bush the First.
Okay, Bush
as
Senior.
The reason to go into the Gulf War.
Oh my God,
and it
really?
Turned out later that she was not actually...
She was a grown woman?
That A, she was a grown woman, and that she was like the daughter to the Kuwaiti ambassador.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
And that it was fake testimony.
Oh my God. I've never even heard this story.
She was like the first crisis actor. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that set us into the Gulf War under Bush the Elder.
I mean, that was one of the pretexts that they used for a war that they were going to go
Absolutely.
Into
but
anyway.
That was a pretext that they used to drum up public support.
That's really interesting. Mm-hmm. So that's turning the tables in that you have a person of color who's not even a child, but posing as a child.
Yes.
Being used to try to garner empathy, which
yes.
that's actually fascinating that even worked, that anyone would actually care. I feel like people care about what kids of color are going through when it suits whatever agenda they wanted it to suit in the first place.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Suddenly they care deeply. But when it doesn't, they're just forgotten.
Yep.
Yeah. So I don't want to take away from people's pleasure at the raccoon's successful rescue. You know, whatever gives you pleasure in these difficult times, you should just enjoy.
But we're just doing our job.
That's what we do. We have to. We have to ruin things. And it does disturb me a little that people can't get so similarly worked up about the suffering of real people, particularly kids.
Yes. Yes.
It's like baby Jessica, 18 month old children are being taken away from their parents right now.
Yeah.
But like, where is that story? Where is that?
Yep. Yep. Where is that story? Why are we not watching that? I mean, I think part of the reason we're not watching it is because those kids are being kept behind closed doors.
True. That's true.
And it's not out in the public where we can watch it unfold minute by minute. I'd like to think that if it was, we would be watching. And I think that that's why they're trying to keep journalists
away from the fucking prison camps. Maybe that's a way to get people to really care, is if you could have a journalist find a kid to be that emblematic kid. Find the kid, like, here's little Anna. She's 3 and she wants to know where her mommy is. And I don't know, maybe people would fucking give a shit then.
Oh, God.
People suck.
We haven't done hot sauce or weak sauce in a while because we've been busy with things that we have to talk to you about. but we have a couple of things we want to mention.
Yes.
I think we want to hot sauce up our allies, or like former allies.
Our country has no allies anymore.
Oh, North Korea is an ally. Oh God. I want to give a hot sauce to Angela Merkel and to that amazing photographer who got that incredible photo of Trump at the G7 with his arms crossed, looking like a fucking toddler while all of these other world leader. Like, it's a brilliant photo.
It's an amazing photo.
That's a Pulitzer right there.
It has a complete story to it with Angela Merkel with like her fists on the table leaning forward. It's amazing. So hot sauce for that. We also want to give hot sauce just to Justin Trudeau for being so fucking sexy all the time.
Yes.
Ooh. Justin, my goodness.
I do want to hot sauce up the Tony Awards. I used to be a theater director. I haven't done it for a long time, and I haven't watched the Tony Awards in forever. However, having the Parkland teens, drama kids singing Seasons of Love, and I hate Rent.
I hate Rent. Oh my God. But I miss the Tonys because I was on a flight at the time, so I didn't get to see them at all. But then afterwards, I saw somebody tweeting about how the Parkland Drama Club had done Seasons of Love. And it just warmed my heart to even think of it, much less see it.
I watched it. I cried. It warmed my cold, dead, Grinch-like heart. Yeah. I also want a hot sauce. The teacher, Melody Hertzfeld, who during the shootings kept 65 students safe in her office and was given an honorary Tony Award.
That's lovely. And
her speech was so beautiful because she was really talking about the impact of the arts on citizens. And I just want to read this quickly. She said, "As theater teachers, we teach kids by giving them space to be critiqued yet not judged, giving them spot in the light yet not full stage, creating the circle of trust in which to fail, telling them long drawn out stories so they can be better listeners, giving students simple responsibilities that are beneath them to encourage character, and stressing to them to be selective as they formulate relationships while welcoming every single side that exists in the world, and also how to begin again."
That's beautiful.
I'm telling you, it was so awesome, and we're both drunk, so we're both a little teary right now.
No, but I also I love that of all the songs they could possibly sing, they chose Seasons of Love from Rent, because when all is said and done, they're still a high school drama club.
So from the high school Parkland teens to Justin Trudeau to Angela Merkel, there was some hot sauce to get us through these terrible times.
It wasn't easy for us to come up with those. We were like, what could we possibly give a hot sauce award to? Everything feels like shit. But there are good things happening, and we want to honor that. That said, have some weak sauce awards to give away. Really one big one.
Oh, go for it.
So we're giving the weak sauce to Trump. I mean, he could have it every week, whatever. But this week particularly, for, as Maya put it, performing the nuclear tango.
Oh, Jesus.
With Kim Jong-un of North Korea.
God, I can't bear it.
I know.
Sometimes I don't know how I'm going to get through the next,
Trump, obviously, every week, every day is doing shit that is awful and condemnable. The reason I think we decided that this week we particularly wanted to give him the weak sauce is because of the cultural significance of what he chose to do. You know, politically, we could get into that. It's maybe a separate conversation, but culturally, it's kind of fascinating. He definitely just put Kim Jong-un on an equal footing with the United States, gave him legitimacy. The images that came out of that quote-unquote summit of, you know, the North Korean flag and the United States flag interspersed together footing, the two of them standing next to each other.
As if this man is not a dictator who is responsible for a totalitarian government in which people live in this brainwashed, horror-starving way. Oh, my God.
I was absolutely and continue to be absolutely in favor of the idea of diplomacy. We should talk to Iran. We should talk to North Korea. Diplomacy is good.
Yes.
I do not believe that anything that happened this past week was diplomacy. I don't think that it forwarded anybody's interests except maybe Kim Jong-un's, in that it gave him a whole collection of images, video and still images, that he can keep going back to show that he is a legitimate leader, recognized by the United States, which means recognized by the entire world. Good for him.
The thing that is so galling to me culturally, I've been thinking about this a lot. Bush the second, one of the things that people would say a lot about him is he's the guy you want to have a beer with, right?
Right, right.
Like Bush the second is like that guy. And a lot of people identified with him on a very personal level.
Yes.
Which I did not, but I'm like, okay.
Right.
And in some ways, I felt more sympathetic to that after Obama was elected because I identified with Obama on a personal level.
Sure.
In a very deep way.
So I'm like, you eat arugula and everything. I get it.
Exactly.
You're an intellectual elite. So he's one of your people.
Absolutely. He's one of my people. And I realized like this is this like disciplined, academic, incredibly academically intelligent guy. Like all of those things are things I believe in. So I'm experiencing what Bush voters must have experienced.
Okay.
Okay. So one of the things that has been the most painful for me is Trump's basic ignorance, his inability to even hand the conversation over to informed people. At least W handed it over to his monsters who knew what was going on.
Right.
It offends me on such a profound level. And one of the New York Times sort of like, Trump's made a whole career off of winging it. And you're like, oh my God, how are you even writing this?
Yeah. So I think that actually does make him relatable to a lot of Americans. I think for a lot of Americans, the fact that he doesn't bother to learn anything.
Right.
He claims to have an instinct about things and he's just going to know when he meets them. He's going to know in the first couple minutes.
Feel it. He's going to feel it.
Feel it out. And I think that a lot of people like that idea. It makes him seem relatable, but I still do struggle with the idea that people find Trump relatable because even given that, he lives in a fucking gold apartment in a fucking tower with his name on it. Like, I get it if you're like, oh, I like that he doesn't bother to learn shit and he doesn't like to read shit. That's just like me. Okay, fine. He's still a completely inhuman caricature. I'm just amazed that anybody looks at that guy and doesn't see right through him. I can't get my head around it. I can't.
All right, guys. Well, sorry to end on such a bummer.
But that's what we do. We ruin shit.
We ruin shit that you love. And also sometimes you just ruin shit that you don't because shit is dire right now. But we love you guys. And we've been so touched and warmed by all of your awesome feedback. So please email us at saucepodcast@gmail.com. We are checking it. Tweet us. Join us on Instagram. Tell your friends about us. Go to iTunes and write a review. It really helps people find our show. And write down what you like about it. Don't just tell us. Tell the world.
Tell the world. Spread the word. Yes, on Twitter and Instagram, we are at Sauce Podcast. You can find me on various social media channels as Gynostar. And you can see my webcomic at gynostar.com.
Which is currently has a really wonderful storyline, by the way, which I highly recommend you guys all follow.
It's getting increasingly stupid. Like, I'm like, everyone's shit people. They're literally shit people. I'm like, I've run out of ideas. Maya, where can people get in touch with you?
They can find me at Maya Grants, MayaGrants@gmail.com, MayaGrants.com, anywhere you're looking for your Maya Grants needs to be met.
Oh, we have to do the Drunkometer.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So Drunkometer is where we rate how drunk we are on a scale from 1 to 10 with one sentence of explanation. Do you want to go first or shall I?
You go first.
Okay. I'm rating myself at a 5, but that's a total like cop out because I'm so tired from lack of sleep that I have no idea how drunk I actually am.
Right. Right. I am kind of at a 4-ish, 5-ish. I would say 15 minutes ago, I was more at a 6, but then, you know, I hit the bottom of my drink and I sort of bounced up from the bottom.
That's why you have to keep the box of wine at the table with you.
No, but I'm out here in the studio, and if I don't mix a second round, I'm just screwed.
So you've got to get a pitcher. Get a pitcher. Think All ahead.
Right. If somebody wants to get me a pitcher, email me and I will give you my address.
No, you could make an Amazon. You got to make an Amazon wish list.
I'm going to make an Amazon wish list.
Do it.
And you're going to send me a special sauce podcast pitcher.
I'm going to fucking make you an Amazon wish list. It's a project. All right.
All right, guys. I'm going to tell you what we're doing next week, because this is one of the things I'm so excited about. It is the World Cup. I fucking live for the World Cup. And so we're going to have a special, extra special, ruining international soccer all of you guys next week.
I'm excited to ruin it.
Anything you want to tell us in advance of that we can incorporate, bring it on.
Bring it on. All right, have a good week. Adios, amoebas.